Welcome to Classic Ethics and Engineering, audio version. This two-hour online course presents the concepts and examples of use of engineering ethics. The concepts are referenced to sources which you can review independently. The examples are from recent engineering catastrophes and less serious failures which may illustrate the consequences of different choices. The course is made up of the following parts: learning objectives, course introduction, course content, discussion, examples and detailed narration, course summary, related links. The course includes a multiple choice quiz at the end. The audio version has two sections, tapes or DVD tracks as you wish to view them. First part is essentially the classic ethics with engineering references. The second part is a detailed discussion of the National Society of Professional Engineers documents and how they might be applied, how they are actually applied, and sometimes the consequences of the way they're applied. At the conclusion of this course, the student will be able to explain meta-ethics, the decision as to whether ethical principles can be applied to the question at hand, be able to explain normative ethics, obligations and permissions, be able to explain theory of value, intrinsic good, be able to list at least 5 different ethical standards that impact engineering decisions, be able to list 5 action items from the Engineer's Creed from the National Society of Professional Engineers, be able to list 6 canons of the National Society of Professional Engineers, 2006 Code of Ethics for Engineers, know where to find 24 rules of practice of the National Society of Professional Engineers, 2006 Code of Ethics. Now, it might sound like there's an awful lot coming from the National Society of Engineers, and that's exactly correct. These are people who've spent a lot of years thinking about this. Their thoughts and documents have been incorporated by most of the state boards of engineering, so it's quite appropriate that we pay considerable attention to the work of the National Society of Engineers. And we will neglect the state societies. In some cases, the state societies and the state boards have different ethics that they emphasize. We're going to skip that because it's so specific to the locality. And again, we'll talk about this generalized versus specific and how these things might apply. You will know where to find the 38 professional obligations of the National Society of Professional Engineers, 2006 Code of Ethics. Now, it sounds like I've got an awful lot of words falling out of my mouth. It's the 2006 Code because it's different from the 2005 Code, and we are trying to be a little bit current on this. Be able to orally review the National Academy of Engineering version of the Challenger disaster. Be able to orally review the National Academy of Engineering version of unsafe procedures at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Be able to orally review the National Academy of Engineering version of structural deficiencies in the Citicorp Tower in New York City. Be able to orally review James Watt's rejection of high-pressure boilers. Now, this thing about the National Academy of Engineering, that may be new to you. It was new to me. Came up from internet search, and there are 3 things to be aware of for the National Academy of Engineering. First, I'm not sure that it exists. The website disappeared after I started copying from it. The second thing is, in fact, they kept saying National Academy of Engineering, but in fact, the name of the website, and here, let me get it exactly correct for you, onlineethics.org. The third thing to keep in mind from the National Academy of Engineering is it's hosted by the Department of Engineering of Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. I have a degree from Case Western Reserve. I'm more than familiar with their operation, and they are a totally honorable place. So even though the website for the National Academy of Engineering has disappeared, the individual pages from Online Ethics still exist, and you can reference this. I am suspicious of people who come and go like gypsies in the night. The intended audience for this course is architects, project managers, engineers, contractors, and construction managers who must make daily engineering decisions. The initiating force was the New Mexico 2006 requirement for 2 PDH, professional development hours, in ethics for PE renewal. The material is not limited to New Mexico. That was mentioned earlier. As I got into research this, New Mexico doesn't require any special material. I have a letter from the board saying, no, any ethics course is fine. Yeah, business ethics course would be great. I've got this in writing. If you're concerned about my interpretation, mention this in the comments section at the end of the quiz, and I'll send you a copy of the letter. Interested technical persons will get value for insights into how philosophy interacts daily with engineering, design, and construction. There's some very, very interesting history and engineering insight in this course. I hope you get full value. Benefit to the audience. Some questions do not lend themselves to easy answer. The value is created by identifying the stakeholders, carefully thinking through consequences, and making and documenting the most acceptable, rational, and emotional decision. Now, this is kind of author's message. I've boiled down the things I've been reading to saying that our goal is the most acceptable, rational, and emotional decision. If you reach a different conclusion, that's good, because the purpose of this course is for you to figure out your structure for applying ethics to design decisions. The course does not present right answers, but does present some tools to assist in analysis of the question at hand. The study of ethics is simple. Do good, avoid evil. Sometimes stated as pursue right, avoid wrong. On the other hand, the study of ethics is complex. Stakeholders include the innocent, naive public, each business trying to profit from the construction, public services, politicians seeking re-election, muckrakers, whistleblowers, and misinformed partisans. Each group defines right and wrong differently. There are a wide range of acceptable ethical decisions, but we must work from a single set of facts. These are the things we will discuss and demonstrate in this course. I hope you will be able to participate in each of the various viewpoints and use the experience to help you make better ethical decisions. The goal of this course is to address daily engineering decisions and help the design professional prepare a justification for his actions. The justification can be used as a guide for future consistent decisions, as a guide for subordinates, as a part of the project record for those who come after us. Now, I'm reading from a little box that's been inserted in the text, and the little box says, in the course of the following discussions, I've made an attempt to separate my personal conclusions from the range of conclusions available. To the extent possible, I will relate the actual decision and consequences. Narration boxes like this one will contain my personal comments, and the narration boxes are not part of the quiz. It's things I had to say or my teeth would blow out. Before we address engineering decisions, however, we need to join the 2,500-year-plus dialogue on ethics. This lets us use common terms and utilize the insights of our predecessors. Meta-ethics tries to identify truth and universal ethical principles, which can be applied to specific situations. And there's an internet reference here from Wikipedia. Both truth and universal ethical principles are very difficult to find. One of the key points of meta-ethics is that there are many very real questions and resulting decisions that do not fall within the realm of ethics. Art is a prime example. Choice of sculpture number one or sculpture number two has no significance beyond the totally personal sense of aesthetics. That's what Wikipedia says. I know a lot of people who feel that their opinion of art is the right opinion of art, and other people are uneducated. And perhaps this ties into some of the things we'll see in engineering as we discuss this later. In my first course of ethics, and we won't mention how many years ago, I did a paper on truth and identified 11 levels of truth as follows. Absolute universal truth, all the time, everywhere, under all conditions. Red is red. Used to be true, but no longer true. Rub butter on a burn, ice on a frostbite. Known not to be true, but acknowledged nonetheless, the emperor's new clothes. Iraq being related to the 9/11 tragedy. Known to be true, but denied by persons in authority. The Holocaust, or the earth being round. Never was true, couldn't possibly be true. Why do they keep saying it? I'm from the government, here to help you. I'll be right with you. We value your call. Current best available technology. Probably obsolete in 18 months. Blu-ray. True here and now only, to be revised next place, next time. Politicians. Best available description of the phenomena, not offered as truth. Orbital description of atoms. Documented word of an expert. James Watt wouldn't work on high-pressure boilers. Now, that's an example that we've mentioned twice, and it will be presented in some detail towards the end of the course. Consistent, repeatable results under controlled condition. Sex produces babies. Absolute, universally false, all the time, everywhere, under all conditions. Red is black. The list is not numbered, because I was never able to rank the levels of truth. It's clear, though, that there are multiple definitions of truth. Note that statutory law, case law, civil law operate under totally different concepts of truth and are not addressed here. The list of 11 types of truth is offered to demonstrate that almost all the time the facts of a situation are severely limited by the interests of the participants. The surprise is that most of the time the participants can agree on a set of facts as the basis to work towards an acceptable decision. This leads very nicely into the quotation presented earlier from George Knepper, professor of history, retired at the University of Akron, Akron, Ohio. There are a wide range of acceptable ethical decisions, but we must work from a single set of facts. Dr. Knepper was lamenting the propensity of young persons to aggressively take positions, though lacking experience or the reading of history. Universal ethical principles also become very slippery on close inspection. For example, a recent bumper sticker said, "Respect all life." This list is presented to demonstrate the conditional aspect of applying something that we really agree with. Does the principle, respect all life, mean not to use antibiotics to kill germs in your bloodstreams? The germs are alive. Does it mean not to use chlorine to treat drinking water? E. coli germs are alive. Does it mean to wear a surgical mask and avoid inhaling microbes and bugs? Does it mean not to shoot a rabid dog? Does it mean not to slaughter cows for meat? Trees are alive. Does it mean we shouldn't eat vegetables either? Does it mean not to execute mass murderers? Does it mean not to offer $25 million for information on the location of someone and use the information to bomb his house and kill him? How does this relate to the U.S. government term collateral damage for people they kill while really trying to kill someone else? Does this mean not to drop two bombs and kill 400,000 Japanese civilians? Is someone trying to twist things so that killing with respect is okay? One of those narrative boxes now. What does this have to do with making ethical engineering decisions? The point is that it's not as easy as finding a good general principle and following. The next section, Normative Ethics, tries to examine how a range of external and internal directives can be applied to specific questions and decisions. Normative Ethics. In this section, we will look at the theory of conduct, theory of value, and stakeholder interests. The first two topics closely follow the Wikipedia article. One theory of conduct is consequentialism. This takes the form of do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. One ought to take action A if and only if A maximizes the amount of good. I have paraphrased it for my children as don't do things that hurt the kid. Consequentialism focuses on the desirability of results. It recommends actions which produce favorable results. Two major problems exist, however. We don't know the future, so any prediction has some value of probability associated with it. And good, unfortunately, is a very flexible word, almost as slippery as truth. I use this guide for my children because it implies value in the future over value in the present, though never explicitly states it. Consequences of car wrecks and hangovers are emphasized. The fun of fellowship and drinking are ignored. Some people really like to get a buzz on. I've heard that term so many times. My daughter says that. My daughter really enjoys wine. I hope she's learned not to drive afterwards. Other theories of conduct are egotism and utilitarianism. It's clear that there are special cases of consequentialism. These are special cases of consequentialism. Egotism defines good as personal good. Utilitarianism defines good as pleasure, happiness, or eudaimonia. I had to include that quote. It comes straight out of the reference source, and I don't run into too many eudaimonias for as many people as possible. And this is from orientalia.org. The full reference is in the paper. The problems with probability and good lead into discussion of theory of value. A very early theory of value postulated that pleasure is good and pain is bad. I've been thinking about this ever since I read this and put it into the paper. And can't you easily think of a lot of situations where pain is actually the better decision? Now, maybe they're talking about pain in an abstract sense rather than pain as a consequence of certain decisions. But this is a very arguable statement that pleasure is good and pain is bad. The concept has been accepted and rejected by philosophers throughout history. See Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and John Stuart Mill. This comes from something called plato.stanford.edu.entries.valueintrinsic-extrinsic. Though meaningful and worth discussion for purely personal reasons, it does not appear to apply to engineering decisions. Pleasure is assumed to be simple and intrinsically good. Similarly, public welfare is often assumed to be simple and intrinsically good. Just as pleasure has been attacked as an imperfect goal, so also is public welfare. We will address this next as we examine the stakeholders associated with an engineering decision. And the point is, who of these stakeholders is the public, and the welfare for whom is public welfare? And if we have to do balancing, what is the appropriate balance? Stakeholders in engineering decisions. Does engineering mean selecting the highest quality material and the highest practical safety margin? No. Engineering means selecting the appropriate material and the appropriate safety margin based upon codes, experience, and intended use. This is going to be emphasized in one of the examples in the second half. The structural engineer specified welded joints. The contractor installed bolted joints without consulting with the engineer. Now, I'm not criticizing the fact that the original engineer of record was not consulted. Deep down inside, I have a little bit of discomfort with that, but the system is set up so that other competent structural engineers are supposed to be able to make good decisions too. In any event, I personally view welded joints as better connections than bolted joints. And then I started on this long line of reasoning, why don't we use rivets anymore? But that's not the point at hand today. We will get into that in one of the examples later on. Engineering means selecting appropriate material and appropriate safety margin based upon codes, experience, and the intended use. In this definition, the basic engineering function incorporates qualifications to simple intrinsic good. The qualifications are in the codes, experience, and the intended use, which implies cost. In fact, there are many groups of persons with qualifications they wish to impose additionally for different reasons. These stakeholders and qualifications include the following: the innocent, naive public, auto drivers, long-haul truck drivers, motorcycle riders, delivery truck drivers. Each business trying to profit from the construction, the design firm, the construction manager, the construction contractor and subcontractor, the owners and the owners' representatives, building standards, EPA, fire department, police department, storm and sanitary waste, potable water, public utilities, gas, electric, telephone and data. Politicians seeking re-election, muckrakers, whistleblowers, and misinformed partisans. This is not intended to be an exhaustive list, but it includes people who may disagree with your decision enough to go to court to get your decision reversed and possibly seek damages from your firm. The stakeholders represent consequences in the sense of the previous discussion of normative ethics. This is direct input to your engineering decision at a balance point we may call engineering ethics. Narrative box follows. I was thinking of an interstate highway bridge or parking deck when I made the list of stakeholders. I'm an auto driver. I appreciate long merge lanes, banking on turns, control of rain runoff to avoid hydroplaning, lane stripes, and rumble strips. I probably appreciate a good base under the thing and the proper rebar, but I don't know about those things, so I don't know to focus on those things. Long-haul truck drivers don't like to tip over, don't like quick merge lanes, weave lanes, or narrowing spiral ramps. The design firm has a profitability goal and a stay-in-business goal. Value setting for design decisions can be badly distorted when the design firm is viewing imminent dissolution. Many government and large industrial construction projects, the construction manager redesigns the installation. That is, essentially, he throws away what was issued in the bid document, and he and the contractor work out another way of doing it entirely. This almost always results from interference and rarely involves review by the original designer. Thus, the first design decision is not the one built, and very different pressures are applied to the field trailer designer. And is the field trailer designer a professional engineer? So many cases, the field trailer designer is an associate of science graduate. Don't start on that. One excellent electrical contractor I frequently work with bids generally from the construction drawings, but recognizes available savings by redesign, which he includes in his bid. We say rigid steel conduit, he says EMT or flex. He's always trying to use plastic, PVC, and non-metallic flex conduit. He tends to group many more conductors in a conduit that's shown on the NEC list at rated capacity. Obviously, the construction contractor is not influenced by the engineering codes of ethics. Now, I say that, but that's not necessarily true. A lot of these construction contractors are very sophisticated. They're part of design-build firms, and they certainly have professional engineers on staff. But we don't see it much in the field redesign. Profit isn't exactly the right word to use describing the motive of owner and owner's representative. During design, the owner wants as many features as he can get and is willing to compromise on building codes. Now, that's a damning statement, but I've seen it so many times I believe it to be true. Not universal, but there is truth in the statement. During construction, owner's representative wants even more, and that's phenomenal. After the price is set, then we start adding features. Has there ever been a project that didn't happen on? Public services, in the current discussion, refers to government agencies which have a vested interest in each decision that forms the design. Building standards must review the design for code compliance and provide inspection against drawings during construction. Building standards is very concerned about life safety, but has little investment in limitations of current technology. Someone is going to have to maintain everything we build. For public projects, the maintainers are government employees. They have an interest in design decisions that are economically maintainable, as shutoff valves located in reachable places. That's one of the problems I ran into. Renovated a huge commercial building for educational use. The reason for the renovation was they had asbestos. When they redid all the piping, they put the shutoff valves where it was easy to put them during construction without any walls in place. Very hard to reach after there were walls, and no, they didn't put any access covers. Another example of this, actually it was on the same project, isn't that interesting? The specifications called for individual HVAC control processors at each air handler, and there were like 9 air handlers, big air handlers. So they were each supposed to have a processor. Well, the construction contractor found it was cheaper to put remote input-output devices in a single central processor. His reasoning was the central processor was so powerful there was no reason for the individual processors. However, the way these things were packaged, when you got an individual processor, you got an operator station. It was a little thing with 4 buttons and an LCD screen, but I mean, you got an operator station. When you got remote I.O., you got no way to see what the machine was doing and no way to modify what it was doing or run any tests whatsoever. So he saved a lot of money, but it made it just about impossible to maintain. Now, interestingly, I caught that on a review. No, I caught that while they were installing them. I thought that was mighty strange to have no way to control the thing. And upon notice, the contractor changed to the full processors. Must have cost him, oh, easily $10,000, maybe $50,000 to make that change. Now, what does this mean about ethics? Well, the maintainer who comes after us is part of the public. It's certainly an owner's representative. It certainly should be considered. Another thing to learn from this, are construction contractors trying to cheat people when they save money on contracts? And my experience has not been that they're trying to cheat anybody. They're trying to stay in business. They're trying to make a profit. They see an opportunity to save money, and they pursue it. Now, is it unethical to change from individual processors to remote input-output devices? Well, if they had thought of what they were doing to the maintenance guy, and again, they had maintenance contracts on most of this stuff, it was their guy they were hurting, they probably wouldn't have made the change. But especially with the pressure of costs involved, they did make the change until it was pointed out, and they changed back. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is listed here because they frequently act in an insane manner. I have worked on several projects where the EPA demanded technology which was not currently available and/or not recommended for the application by the provider. Since the EPA can hold up public funds and always inserts an approval delay, they are a stakeholder and very important to the designer and owner. One of these applications, it still amazes me when I review it. Are you familiar with wastewater treatment? They usually have a screening stage at the beginning of the treatment facility just to keep the big rocks, you know, the picnic tables, the lumber out of the process. You don't run a digester on a piece of treated lumber. Well, so they have screening in the front of it. Usually it's pretty coarse screening, sometimes with some rakes on the screening to keep the screens clear so that the water can go through. EPA demanded very fine screening. Well, when you got very fine screening, it plugs up almost immediately. One of your choices is to give them a lot more square feet of surface area so it can plug up and still work. You've got to do some pretty good raking if you want those things to work. But the EPA appears, or in this project, which was at least 10 years ago, appeared to have no real-world experience when they were setting their standards. They demanded something that was outright impossible. It wouldn't work. And maybe this is something you learn from the EPA. You install it their way, but make sure the bolts are loose so you can take it out after it's done. Wasn't that a terrible thing to say? That almost sounds like the sewer plant I worked on where they weren't allowed to put an overflow basin, so they just arranged the runoff with some open tanks. Oh my, let's not talk about EPA. But they're a stakeholder. They're someone who must be considered when you're making engineering decisions. They've got a list. When they review your plans, they tell you, you must change this item. And you pretty well have the choice of changing that item. You can argue if you want, but again, that's an engineering decision. How much schedule slip can you afford and still be a happy camper? The fire department wants to be able to get their emergency equipment across the bridge, into the parking garage, or up to the structure for a fire. For the most part, the fire department does get a chance to review them, but certainly not enough time, and is not consulted on any field changes. Police department has never been consulted on any project I have worked on in 35 years, but they have an interest in lighting, security, access for emergency vehicles, maybe tow trucks in this case. The town where I work occasionally has heavy thunderstorms. There are several interstate highway overpasses where highway goes under a railway that flood during and following these storms. From the depth of the water, which is 2 to 3 feet, they need pumps or a much better plan for water runoff. The situation results from compromises made during design, oversights made during design, or a lack of follow-through by the Stormwater Maintenance Agency. I assert this is exactly the engineering ethics question, which is the core of this course. If ambulances can't get through, doesn't that affect public welfare? Politicians are part of the review procedure for public projects. It's sometimes hard to see the public interest they are representing. In the town mentioned earlier, a six-lane interstate enters from the south. Six-lane interstate passes through east to west. They join downtown in several miles of 2- and 4-lane highway, so it necks down considerably with multiple interstates merging. One of the original designers told me that every report from their office indicated the scheme would be unworkable. Politicians insisted on it, and it works well, except, of course, from 7 to 10 in the morning and 3 to 6 in the afternoon when traffic becomes stop and go. Political decision was to minimize impact on neighborhoods. Obviously, these politicians were elected by roadway neighbors, not roadway users. Another very obvious example from politicians and engineering ethics is best summarized by the electricity deregulation fiasco out of Washington, D.C. The engineers' organization, the IEEE, volunteered thousands of hours of data gathering and presentation to demonstrate the adverse effects on the public of deregulating electricity. It's reported that Enron donated about $5 million to the politicians on the committee to cause deregulation to move forward. In the town just mentioned, there are two TV stations with investigative reporters. Too many design decisions on public projects are formed to meet the requirement of hiding government operations from these muckrakers. Muckrakers do file lawsuits, which result in depositions, hearings, fines, and revocation of professional licenses. They seem to really enjoy getting a director of public utility suspended. And if we work a little longer, we could probably figure out the motivation. Oh, they're looking for ratings. That's why they do that. And a controversy is good for ratings. Why does it have to overflow into engineering? Whistleblowers are persons working within the project who are so offended by the decisions made that they forfeit future employment and accept public ridicule by informing the news media. Surprisingly, even though all stakeholders who were part of the decision agree, a single person is usually elected to take all the blame if they get caught and go to jail if needed, pay any fines levied. When they first got this idea of sending company executives to jail, I remember there was a controversy that they should have a vice president in charge of going to jail in each large corporation. Is it a valid execution of professional ethics to internally broker a decision which will not survive public review? And unfortunately, that's what happens when we compromise. Everybody has to give up a little bit. Each person has very strong feelings about what's right, but in order to get anything built, we each have to give up a little bit of what we think is right. We're going to see that in some of the examples later. This is the reason that some firms require a signed ethics statement forbidding any unethical behavior or behavior that might be viewed as unethical. And after they have the form, they can tell you to do anything or lose your job and probably be blacklisted. Misinformed partisans are single-topic pressure groups who seek a particular goal without regard to facts, effects on other interested parties, or long-term consequences. Photovoltaic generation, electric generation is a good example. Technology uses toxic heavy metals, extremely toxic. It is dangerous to researchers and to production operators. It's dangerous to wastewater plants handling normal waste from the plant, and extremely dangerous to the community in the event of unplanned spills. Photovoltaic generation is extremely expensive compared to other sources and suffers deterioration and demise in the 5 to 10 year range. Photovoltaic, however, is promoted by green groups and rewarded as a design choice by a prominent quasi-governmental organization. If someone were to ask, you might say that different ethical standards that impact engineering decisions are codes, health and welfare consequences for the naive public, profitability and survival of the firm, political benefits, effects of public exposure, maintainability, and special interest groups. A little bit of comment from the National Society of Professional Engineers, then we'll finish this section of the tape or audio version. This is from the 1954 National Society of Professional Engineers creed. There are four action items on this creed. I mentioned the 1954 because on their website, where they still offer this creed, it's listed as the 1954 creed. National Society of Professional Engineers publishes a creed which claims copyright protection and can only be paraphrased here. The creed may not be specific enough to warrant carrying a copy in your wallet or purse. The creed says, "I will use my professional knowledge and skill for the advancement and betterment of human welfare. I pledge to deliver the utmost of performance to none but honest activities, to follow the laws of man and the highest standards of professional conduct, to place service before profit, honor and standing of the profession before personal advantage, and public welfare above all other considerations. Being humble and seeking divine guidance, I make this pledge." Whoa, that kind of heavy duty. Let's look at this a little bit. And again, these are my views. You may have different views. And figuring out where you stand is the goal of the discussion, not so much hearing what your author has to say. Advancement and betterment of human welfare. Does this forbid participating in a project to tear down a good old building and construct a crummy new building? Engineers always seem to be on the side of the concrete and glass and tearing down the historic building that hasn't quite made the National Register. I'm not sure that's ethical. I mean, I'm not telling you it's not ethical. I'm telling you it's a concern to me. I mean, when we talk about public welfare, doesn't this include future generations? Are future generations really better served by concrete and glass than they are by wood frame and cupolas? Never mind. How well does this match up with the World War II project to kill 400,000 Japanese? Maybe there are implied qualifications when the NSPE says betterment of human welfare. For 50 years, the public utilities worked very hard to eliminate industrial electrical generation plants that were built in the 1930s. The plants provided local reliability, economy, and competition. It was the competition the utilities wished to avoid. Where is human welfare in utility PEs fighting local generation? To deliver the utmost of performance. Now just think what those words mean. The medical profession uses the following definition of standard of care. This comes from someplace called mediterms.com. The level at which the average prudent provider in a given community would practice. The medical malpractice plaintiff must establish the appropriate standard of care and demonstrate the standard of care has been breached. This course is not offering legal advice. It would appear, however, that for professional medical service, the average practice is the standard, not the utmost performance. None but honest activities. The State Board of Registration are very big on this. If a conviction is on record, anyone bringing it to the attention of the board can get a hearing, well, usually can get a hearing, and some likelihood of revocation of the perpetrator's license. Is it honest for an engineer to have a close relationship with a single supplier without revealing this to the client? Most engineers have preferred providers and lack knowledge about competitors. Is this really honest, or just another example of concealed behavior not being actionable? If an architect shops a job among engineers to get the lowest price, and even comes back for a second round, is this honest? Interestingly, this is forbidden by the American Institute of Architects when the architect is the design professional. But I have seen it so many times when the architect is the prime and the consulting engineer is the subcontractor. What does that tell us about ethics? I think there's a message there, and I can't quite identify it. There is a question here. What percent of the activity in your firm is attained upon the basis of competitive bidding? And how honest is that? Follow the laws of man and the highest standards of professional conduct. In this context, follow the law usually means don't bribe public officials, not to be confused with political action committees or independent action groups set up by the state party. How should this NSPE mandate be interpreted when the owner of the firm says to give the checks to him and he will deliver them to the candidate? The highest standard of professional conduct is too much for medical doctors. Are we sure we wish to impose it on ourselves? What about the lower half of the profession? This is one of the nasty truths of statistics. There's always a lower half. These are people who don't perform as well, make more mistakes, but no matter what you do, there will always be a lower half. Do we expect to catch all of their errors in quality assurance review or when building standards gets the permit? Service before profit. I'm sorry, survival is the primary objective. Like everything else, this is an absolute statement that has a lot of qualifications and exceptions. But I'm saying that this absolute statement has a little more prominence than service before profit. Service is an 8-to-5 deliverable when it doesn't conflict with lunches or vacations. Followed by a narrative box, I've been trying to make this course an objective presentation of a range of standards and interpretations. The goal is to put you in a position to make a decision you can justify and live with. At this point, I must step outside the boundary. I strongly believe that a client, owner, or contractor should be able to leave a message and reasonably expect an answer the next business day. I don't see this level of service in more than 5% of the professional firms and persons I deal with. People don't check their voicemail, don't delegate when they're out of town, and nobody enforces a standard. And there are some exceptions of salespersons who leave meaningful messages on their voicemail and seem to try seriously to get back in contact. Place the honor and standing of profession before personal advantage. I am not sure what this means. I specify copper wire because 20 years ago there were fires when aluminum wire was used. The aluminum salesman says the problems have been solved and the owner can save lots of money by using aluminum. From engineering, I believe this to be true. From years of dealing with owners, I don't want to start the discussion. It will go on and on. Non-technical people will make technical decisions using bizarre logic and misinterpreted experience, and I will have to defend the decision to every electrical engineer I meet. I am weak. If it's a publicly funded project, we're wasting public money and adversely affecting the public welfare by wasting funds that could be put to beneficial use. Being humble. My previous boss once stated that he knew everything. When I mentioned this at a meeting, he qualified it that he knew everything about HVAC. There's something about being successful that includes a little arrogance. I'm not sure that a survey of NSPA members would certify the property of being humble as part of their personal creed. Join me, please, for the next section, part two. We will talk about the canons of the NSPE, very much the core information embedded in this document.